Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a special playoff edition of the Blue Jays From Away podcast. This is episode 17.
Got this force coming through in my blood, in my veins. It's a current of love, a chorus of...
Today, we're going to talk with Tyler Murray about the Dunedin Blue Jays playoff hopes, with Charlie Caskey about the Vancouver Canadiens, and with Trey Wilson about the Bluefield Blue Jays. So sit back, ladies and gentlemen, take a listen, and get your Blue Jays on. It's the Blue Jays From Away podcast, playoff edition. Welcome back to the Blue Jays From Away podcast. I am here once again with Tyler Murray, the play-by-play voice of the Dunedin Blue Jays. We're going to talk about the Blue Jays and their upcoming playoff series with the Daytona Cubs. How are you doing, Tyler?
I'm great, Mike. Thanks for having me on again. Always a good time to be with you.
Well, we're definitely glad to have you, and we're definitely looking forward to talking some playoff baseball. It's been an interesting second half of the season for the Dunedin Blue Jays, hasn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. It's been up and down. They had a stretch of 18 games when they had six losses, then six straight wins, then six straight losses. So, I mean, that's the definition of an up and down half, if you ask me. But, you know, they've really come together well lately. They'd actually lost 10 of their last 11 games before the final series of the season, and they just won 3 out of 4 against Clearwater. It's a cliche to say that they're getting hot at the right time, but that's exactly what's happened. They won 3 of 4 with 2 shutouts, and then yesterday was a 16-2 win, so I don't know how I can be on more of a roll than the Blue Jays are right now entering the postseason, which starts up tomorrow.
Well, that's actually one of the first things I was going to ask you was, not only have they been hot, the bats have been pretty unbelievable over the last little while, which is something that has really been one of the weak points, especially in the second half for the Dunedin Blue Jays.
Yeah, well, compared to the pitching, I'd say the hitting is a little bit behind, but you look at a couple of guys that have stepped up lately. I'm going to highlight Casey Hobson here, I think, first. He got six RBIs yesterday in the first three innings with a RBI double, a three-run homer, and a two-run single in his first three ABs. Obviously, you're going to get a ton of plate appearances in a 16-2 win. And for Hobson, he had been going through a stretch where he'd played two straight weeks in the field. Now, in the Florida State League, I'm sure you can imagine how hot it is out there. And when you get the designated hitter spot, that almost feels like a day off because you're not standing out in the sun the entire game for almost, I don't know, two hours of total time, including your at-bats. So that's always rough on guys. And the Blue Jays have so many injuries at first base throughout the organization and in Dunedin alone that Hobson has been forced pretty much to play first base all the time with no DH breaks. But he got the night off two nights ago, the DH 3 days before that. Then he comes in nice and refreshed to that game yesterday, and you see the results 4-for-5 with six runs batted in. And another guy who stepped up big time lately is Matt Newman. He's been inserted into the three slot during this last week. Really, the entire season he's been from the five spot and below, which has been great for the consistency of the lineup because he's hitting .290 now this season, six homers, 37 RBIs. But since he's been put in that three slot, Newman is actually 7 for his last 13, and he's got a homer, 4 RBIs, 3 runs scored. So we're now seeing that production, not just getting him on base with consistent hitting, but knocking in those runs when guys like John Burry and Derek Chung can get on base in front of him. So it seems like Bobby Meacham, the manager, has found the right formula for getting some runs across. Although, 2 days ago, they did get shut out 6-0, but still, they outscored the Threshers by over 30 runs total in that 4-game series. So it's pretty impressive.
That's definitely an impressive series. Now, moving forward, they're playing the Daytona Cubs, who have been a very strong team this year. How does the matchup look for the Blue Jays in that series?
Well, obviously, starting pitching is going to be the first thing you look at. And for Game 1, it's actually a matchup that does favor the Blue Jays. Now, this is projected, but we're almost positive we're going to have Austin Bibbins-Dirks back from AA New Hampshire. He's actually leading the Blue Jays minor league system in almost every major pitching category, wins, ERA, whiff, batting average against for a starter, whatever you want to call it. And for the Cubs, I think the Blue Jays catch a bit of a break here. The Cubs have to send out Corey Black. That's how the rotation shakes out. Now, Black has had a very good year with Daytona. He was the big trade piece, one of the trade pieces, I guess I'll say, when the Alfonso Soriano went from Chicago to the Yankees. The Tampa Yankees moved him from their affiliate to Daytona. So he went from Florida State League team to Florida State League team. When he was with the Yankees, the Blue Jays faced him 5 times. He had a 4.45 or 4.45 ERA, yeah, and an 0-1 record. He also pitched in the game that the Blue Jays won on June 19th to clinch the first half championship. The bottom line is the Blue Jays have faced Corey Black before. They've had success against him, and it's a good draw for them because game one is on the road, and the next two guys that they will likely face at home for game two and then game three if necessary in the three-game series are probably going to be C.J. Edwards, who's been lights out, and Pierce Johnson, who was a first-round pick of the Cubs last season. So they get to face those two guys at home, and Corey Black, who is a beatable pitcher on the road against the veteran Austin Bibbins-Dirks. I think for game one, the matchups do favor the Blue Jays, but offensively, the Cubs have just been red hot. I'm sure you know they got Chris Bryant, who won Florida State League Player of the Week last week, the number two overall pick in this year's draft, 2013. So a very young, very raw talent. He's been tremendous. And they also brought in a second-round pick from 2 years ago, Dan Vogelbach, a huge power bat, and they have one of the leading RBI guys in the league, Dustin Geiger. So the offense is definitely there for the Cubs. However, they have not faced Austin Bibbins-Dirks all too often this season. So at least starting pitching-wise, on paper, the Blue Jays have a good shot to steal game one on the road.
Well, that's great, and I was going to ask you about Bibbins-Dirks coming back from New Hampshire, as well as Casey Lawrence, who has been sent down, and we're wondering who's going to be taking game two and three. Where does Aaron Sanchez fit in this in the way the pitching rotation shakes out? And would Daniel Norris be considered for a start, or is he going to be tagged to go out of the bullpen?
Well, we'll start with Sanchez first. He's projected to be able to start game two on Wednesday, and on Wednesday it'd be 5 days since his last start, so that's what it's shaking out to be right now. That would be huge for the Blue Jays. Sanchez has been tremendous so far this season at home, and I'm sure you've looked into his recent starts. He was tremendous last time out. The pitch count is now up to 90, which is really good news for him, and you never want to get injured, but maybe it was a bit of a blessing in disguise for him to have that injury on May 18th that kept him out for over a month, because there's no more worry about his innings limit. They aren't too careful with him right now because they want to get him those innings to make sure he gets a decently full season regimen in terms of pitches and innings worked. Last time out against Clearwater, 7 innings, no runs, 5 hits, a walk and 4 strikeouts. He was economical. The fastball was around 96, 97, so he wasn't going all out with his heater, which is good because he can pace himself a little bit more. Opponents hitting just 202 against him now, which is in the top 5 among Florida State League starters in terms of holding opponents to a low batting average so far this season. But the 7-inning outing last time out was his longest start of the season by far and his most effective, I think, having gone that long. His other long outing was against Daytona, believe it or not. It was all the way back in April, but he went 6 2/3, allowed just 1 run on 2 hits. And the good news for Sanchez is that, as we said, he's coming back home. On the road, he's still been solid, but his home record, 4-2, with a 2.72 ERA, and opponents hitting 173 against him versus on the road where they're at 250. Obviously, a lot of factors go into struggles at home versus on the road, but for whatever reason, it seems like Sanchez has been great at those 6:30 starts right on the dot at Florida Auto Exchange Stadium in Dunedin, and that's what we're hoping to see and what we should be able to see for Game 2. He definitely is the scheduled and projected starter for Game 2. Now, Daniel Norris, that's still kind of a up-in-the-air situation. Not quite sure for Game 3 yet. Talked with Bobby Meacham, the manager. He said that they're definitely thinking about Daniel Norris potentially for Game 3. Not official yet. And that's a decision that has to be made not only by the Dunedin Blue Jays, but by the entire organization, because Norris is obviously such a highly touted prospect. You want to make sure you're using him in the right way, not getting too many innings out of him. And he was so good in his first start with the Blue Jays on the 30th against Clearwater. That was on Friday as part of that combined one-hit shutout. 5 innings, 1 hit, 2 walks, 1K. And obviously quite dominant for the new left-hander in Dunedin. And it would be great to see him pitch Game 3. We're not sure. With Casey Lawrence being brought down from Double-A, he's a good candidate to get that start as well. I don't think he can really go wrong, though, if the series gets that far, that is.
Great. And again, it's great to see that the prospects are at least making the staff have to think about who they're going to use, in addition to wanting to consider the veterans as well. I wanted to ask you actually about Sanchez and Norris in particular, because both of them had recent starts where they didn't rack up the strikeout numbers quite as much as they have in the past. And my question is, are they being asked to pitch to contact a little bit more? Are they trying to get the batters? And it's clear that Sanchez was doing that in getting through 7 innings, his longest start, as you mentioned, and only 1 walk. And my initial thought was he's probably pitching to contact a little bit more and going to get outs quicker rather than having to throw a lot of pitches, throwing a lot of balls, throwing a lot of pitchers that will try to get batters to swing at things out of the strike zone, as well as trying to rack up strikeouts. Is that something that you've seen with both Norris and with Sanchez?
Yeah, I would actually agree with that, Mike. Darryl Knowles, the longtime pitching coach and Florida State League Hall of Famer for the Blue Jays, he's a wizard in Dunedin, and he has a philosophy. If I could bet you $100 you would throw a strike, which pitch would you use? And the answer there would be a fastball for both Sanchez and Norris. They have really good breaking stuff, curveballs and sliders and changeups, but their fastballs definitely is what gets them through. There were a ton of fastballs thrown from Daniel Norris on two-pitch strikes against two-strike counts, I guess I should say, against Clearwater in his only start with the Blue Jays. And he didn't really need to go to the breaking stuff too much, more to set up hitters to get the fastball by him. And as a lefty, being able to throw 95 consistently is a huge weapon for Norris and the Blue Jays. And I think right now at the stage in their careers, they're just trying to establish the fastball, trying to get it over the strike zone, and then if need be, using the breaking balls later in the counts to get the punch outs. But the fastballs, they look so good off the hands for these hitters. They're taking a lot of early swings. Now, it should be noted that against Clearwater, which both Sanchez and Norris were able to dominate, that's the Phillies affiliate, and they happen to be a very free-swinging team. So that may have helped out the Blue Jays' two prospects a little bit, but I just think the confidence is growing, knowing they have that fastball that they can get by pretty much any hitter, and then if need be, using the breaking stuff. Sanchez has been growing more and more confident with the changeup and the curveball as the season has gone on. But I think last time out, it was the adjustments that were good. Maybe in the first couple of innings, it was a lot of fastballs. Same story for Norris. A lot of fastballs early, and then he would actually start hitters off with even changeups or curveballs just to catch them off guard. And then they'd be sitting on maybe a fastball to mix things up, but they get another change and just weakly ground one out to the shortstop. And we got Emilio Guerrero up here now, recently promoted from Lansing. So there's a lot of new talent out there with the Blue Jays here in Dunedin, and it's good timing, I think, to get them set for the playoffs.
Well, that's one thing I was going to ask you, is how are the new guys fitting in? You've got Guerrero, you had Matt Boyd up, and apparently he's been transferred to the GCL roster. I guess he's not going to be around during the playoffs, or not going to be available during the playoffs. I also noted that Taylor Cole was up there, and he has been placed on the DL as well. So there are definitely some guys coming in from Lansing and a couple of guys coming down from New Hampshire. How are they fitting in?
Oh, tremendously well. You can look at the left side of our infield, Gustavo Pierre, and then at third base, and then at shortstop, either Jorge Flores or Emilio Guerrero, and then Shane Opitz, if he can come off the DL in time for the playoffs. All of those guys on the left side of the infield started the season in Lansing, so it's been a nice little reunion for them, and obviously pretty much everybody on this ball club played with each other at the lower levels before. There are a couple of exceptions. Derek Chung, Matt Newman, and Nick Baliga came straight from Vancouver, which is two levels below, but obviously they've fit in quite well here in the clubhouse, and it's all about familiarity. These guys have definitely played together before. It's nice to see them coming up the ranks together, and with all the talent that they have, you don't even need a good club, a clubhouse with good chemistry to get things done, but the Blue Jays have that, and that's always good to see.
So is there anything we should look out for in Dunedin going into these playoffs?
Well, I think the biggest advantage the Blue Jays have in the postseason, in the first series anyway, against Daytona, is that bullpen. You really can't overlook the matchup ability that they have. Two different guys to look at: Will Browning, the right-handed sidearmer, and Tony Davis, the left-handed submariner. Bobby Meacham was able to use those two guys in one individual inning after a couple of rainouts. He needed to get everybody in there to get some work, but we got a taste of what it could be like in the playoffs. Browning came on, struck out two righties, and then Davis came on, struck out two lefties. Will Browning recently, he's another guy who spent most of the season in Lansing. So far in 10 relief outings for Browning, 2-0 with a 1.02 ERA, 15 strikeouts and no walks. He's just one of seemingly dozens of guys out of the bullpen that can get it done for you. Dustin Andelin, a 2.35 ERA. You got Jesse Hernandez, a great start yesterday. He might be a long reliever out of the bullpen in the playoffs. Blake McFarland, the Blue Jays closer, top three in saves in the league. A.J. Meyer, a 2.77 ERA, 76 Ks against 8 walks. And then Tyler Ybarra, who I think was a bit of a snub for the end-of-season All-Star team, a 1.95 ERA. The lefty can throw 95-plus, and opponents are hitting a league low, 1.56 against them. He's pitched in 39 games, and no pitcher has held opponents to a lower batting average than Tyler Ybarra, the left-hander. So there are a ton of options out of the bullpen for the Blue Jays. Everybody's on schedule for Tuesday's game if need be. So if they can have a lead with Austin Bibbins-Dirks on the mound, which there's a decent chance could happen, then with the bullpen coming on in Daytona, even though it's a tough road atmosphere, you have a ton of faith in what this bullpen could be able to do.
Well, it sounds like the bullpen is definitely one of the assets that the Dunedin Blue Jays have, and hopefully they won't be called on too much, which will reflect that we'll have some great starting outings as well, and hopefully the offense will be able to provide some fireworks to back those guys up.
That's right. And now, on paper, the Blue Jays do come in as the underdog just because the Cubs had a 10-game winning streak snapped just 2 days ago. They won yesterday in their regular season finale, so I guess they've won 11 of their last 12, and the season series was dominated by Daytona, including back-to-back doubleheaders last week that were all won by the Cubs. They won 4 out of 4, but I think the Blue Jays like it that way. They were able to come through in the clutch in the first half, 4 straight wins. When they needed to win all their games to finish out the first half, they won by just half a game because Brevard County, who was half a game back, won 5 in a row to close out the season. So there's a ton of clutch hitters and clutch performers on this ball club. Great to have Casey Lawrence back. Just one example, he was the guy who got the first half division clinching win all the way back on June 19th. So there's definitely a winning atmosphere. And this is the Blue Jays' 4th consecutive playoff appearance. They have not won a Florida State League title, though. The atmosphere and the attitude right now is, why not this team? They've come this far. They've got hot at the right time. And with a matchup against Daytona that everyone seems to be picking, the Cubs, including MILB.com. A recent article gave, I think, 7 paragraphs to Daytona with quotes and analysis. And then for the Blue Jays, they wrote, Aaron Sanchez, the top prospect, he might start game 2. John Birdie leads the league in stolen bases. That's not a big deal, but it's bulletin board material, perhaps, to get the Blue Jays fired up, and they know they have the talent to get it done, so we're definitely looking forward to the first round series.
Great, and that gets underway tomorrow. It's Tuesday. By the time people hear this, it probably won't be tomorrow, but we hope everybody can listen in to Tyler Murray about the Blue Jays, Dunedin Blue Jays, playing in the playoffs against the Daytona Cubs with that series starting on Tuesday. Want to thank you very much, Tyler, and we wish the Blue Jays and we wish you the best of luck for the rest of the season.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Mike. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot. Next, I talk to Vancouver blogger Charlie Caskey about the Vancouver Canadiens and what's going to happen with them going into the playoffs. Welcome back to the Blue Jays From Away podcast. This is our special playoff edition of the podcast. We're joined by Charlie Caskey from Vancouver, where they're about to get their playoffs underway on Tuesday night. Welcome to the podcast again, Charlie.
Thank you. I think this is my third time on, and it's getting better and better.
I hope so. And and I think with the playoffs upon us, things are getting better and better in Vancouver. So why don't you tell me about how the season has sort of come to an end and how they're gearing up for the playoffs?
Well, perfect timing, really. I was just in the middle of writing my series preview, or at least tonight's playoff preview. The Seas, they've literally backed their way in. They had a terrible second half, both record-wise, and we could bring up any statistical category you want to talk about, except for maybe the starting pitching, which has been pretty good. But other than that, they've had a pretty poor second half, and you know, for my series preview, I was trying to think of some of the reasons, and I just can't come up with anything sort of solid to grasp onto. I mean, they did lose Jordan Leland, who was their best hitter. He got promoted. But with him went Dan Klein, who was a backup catcher. Eric Brown went up, but he was more than amply replaced by the call-ups of Tom Robson and Shane Dawson. So I can't quite put my finger on why they struggled so much in the second half. You know, Mike Reeves, the catcher from Ontario, who had a brilliant first half, you know, but his batting average of balls in play was ridiculous. And that was always going to normalize, and it has. LB Gansler struggled a bit down the stretch. It's tough. They're a singles hitting team, and when you're not getting all the singles you need and other things aren't executing properly, sometimes it's tougher to score runs. But everything resets now. And, you know, Vancouver is pretty excited about it because obviously Vancouver is a hockey town and the Canucks aren't playing right now. So everybody's sort of focused on the Canadiens at the moment. And, I'm looking to the south and the clouds are breaking after quite a bit of rain this morning. So hopefully we get the game in.
Great. And who is slated to start game 1 for the Vancouver Canadiens?
Local boy, Tom Robson is getting a start, which is on, I believe I had a normal rest for him, so 5 days rest. He'll, you know, I'm not going to assume, I haven't spoken to them yet, but I'm guessing he'll be on his normal pitch count of 80 pitches. So hopefully he uses that effectively and pitches, you know, sixth, seventh inning. And I talked about it, I think, in my piece yesterday, whereas the bullpen's been a bit of a sore spot for the Canadians this season. It has been beefed up a bit with the additions of Chase DeYoung, got called up yesterday. He arrived last night from Bluefield. And again, I haven't confirmed this yet, but when I spoke to Shane Dawson last week, he said if they did make the playoffs, he would come off the DL and be in the bullpen. And guys like Alonso Gonzalez, who won't be in the staff initially, will be in the bullpen as well. So hopefully that won't be an issue.
Right. Gonzalez actually had a very good start the other day, so he probably isn't available for tonight's game, is he?
I wouldn't have guessed tonight. Yeah, they'll piggyback Robson with either Dermody or Silverstein tonight, I would have guessed. And I don't know who pitched yesterday. I haven't looked at the box, but neither of those guys pitched. So one of the two left-handers of the pen will come in after Robson. Yeah, Gonzalez has had two great starts in a row, actually. And, you know, anything out of him positive is a great sign, because the physical tools for him are there. It's just a matter of getting him to repeat his delivery.
Well, you know, and I saw him very early in the year in Lansing, and with Gonzalez, I think it's, again, it's a matter of control and command. And he actually skipped Vancouver earlier in the season. I think I wrote about that when he was sent down. So he skipped Vancouver altogether last year. I think he was in Bluefield for the season and then jumped right up to Lansing. And I think he's still a young guy. I think he's only about 21, which makes him, aside from DeYoung, Robson, Gabreski, aside from those guys, he's one of the younger pitchers on that staff, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he was drafted out of a junior college. So yeah, he was drafted at 20 or 21, like you said. And he's a big dude. He's 6'5", 220 or whatever he is, you know, so he's got some projectability. He was just struggling when he came down, which was the same problem he'd had in Lansing. He was just letting his front side stay open. So he was losing his changeup to his arm side, and then overcompensating with his fastball with a crossfire, sort of excessive crossfire delivery. So the tools are there, but like some of the other left-handers in the system, you know, Daniel Norris being one, they're just struggling to get them, once they get on the mound, to repeat their deliveries and, you know, be more consistent with their location. But if he's found it and, you know, judging by the last couple starts he has, then great. He'll be back up in Lansing next year as part of what should be quite an exciting young staff.
So let's talk about the Game 2 starter for the Canadians in their series against Everett. Who do we have going in Game 2?
I'm 99% sure it'll be Jeremy Gabreski. He was due to start yesterday, and he would have if they needed the win to get in, but he was skipped, and they did a bullpen committee sort of thing. So it will be Gabreski Game 2. He's been up and down as of late. He had, I think it was 3 starts ago, he had an excellent start, went 6 innings with only 2 hits and no earned runs. And then he's had a couple where, you know, they like to, I'm not saying that they're making excuses, they sometimes say umpires can't, you know, he doesn't pitch well to umpires because he needs to live down in the zone, and umpires at this level, you know, those strikes at the knees, they don't pick up quite as well. But I think he's been missing a lot with his breaking balls. I saw his start in Vancouver, which would have been now his last start this season. I wasn't tracking it, so I couldn't tell you the exact specifics, but he was missing with his fastball up. And when you've got his velocity, which isn't plus, you know, fastballs missed up are going to get hit, and they were. And then he was missing with his breaking balls up as well. So if he can live down in the zone and keep his curveball down, and get on top of it, he should be okay. If he doesn't, then he could be in a bit of trouble.
And Gabreski has definitely had seen, you know, his first half of the season, he had some eye-popping stats. He's definitely come back to earth, I guess. Is that a factor of fatigue? Is it a factor of, missing the zone? Is it a factor of the league sort of figuring him out a little bit?
I think it's that last one more than anything. I did a quick study, and if you look at some of his starts in the second half, it was teams that had seen him for the second and third time. And it's tough to get a full gauge of, because I mean, obviously there's turnover on the other team, so it's not like the full roster has seen him for a second time. You know, guys come up, guys, you know, promoted, demoted, etc. But yeah, teams that have seen him 2 and 3 times are when he gets into a bit of trouble. You know, there's not much in the way of scouting reports here, but you know, teams remember, you know, coaches remember, so they'll be able to give, you know, sort of a preview to the players that haven't seen him, and the players that have seen him sort of know what's coming. So for me, that's the main factor. And I'm just going through his stats here. This will be his third start against Everett. He's beaten him both times he's pitched, and pitched very well. In fact, by the looks of it, both starts, he only gave up 2 hits and no runs. So, I mean, you hope he carries on with that, but we'll see how it goes.
There's one player that I think hasn't gotten a lot of attention. He was sort of a late-round pick of the Blue Jays this year in the 28th round, and it was actually his 4th time drafted, and he really didn't improve his draft standing each time that he was drafted, and that's Matt Dermody. And Dermody, he's maybe an older guy, but his stats in Vancouver are pretty incredible, with a 1.77 ERA, a 1.20 whip, but 4 walks in just 40 and two-thirds innings to go with 50 strikeouts. That's pretty impressive. Is it? Is he sort of one of the most unheralded pitchers on that staff?
Well, and that's the funny part. So much so that I've never bothered to go down and interview him, which when you look at his stats, you know, he's one of the biggest stories. And like you say, the fact that he was drafted 4 times, never all sort of within 6 rounds of each other. But yeah, he's been absolutely sensational. And It has gone on under the radar a lot. I did a piece with Chad Hillman, who writes for OK Blue Jays, and you know, he wanted to know, he lives in Lansing and covers them, and he wanted to know some of the names that maybe, you know, aren't on the radar right now, but that you should look forward to in Lansing next year. And I mean, I think he's definitely one of them. He's, as you say, his 12.5 strikeout to walk ratio is phenomenal. And He's a big guy. He's a bit skinnier. Like if you talk about the other big left-hander they have in the bullpen here, Scott Silverstein, he's 6'5", 250. I mean, he's at his sort of peak physical stature at the moment. Dermody, he might have a bit of room to grow still, even though he is 22 or whatever he is. 23, sorry. He doesn't throw particularly hard, but, you know, he's got a wipeout slider, and I think that's been his best pitch so far this season. So it'll be interesting to see what happens for him. I mean, I think it's great that we've got him now, and I think he will, you know, play a big role. I think probably in today, he'll piggyback for Robson in today's game.
Now here's a question about Dermody. I mean, he's a lefty, which you love to see the lefties with the slider. Do you know how hard he throws, number one? And number two, does he sort of come down from the side, or is he more of an over the top pitcher?
He throws sort of low 90s. He'll get it 90, 91, and he's more of a 3/4 arm slot, whereas Silverstein is probably throws it harder. He can get it up to 94, 95, but he's got that exaggerated crossfire sort of Aaron Loop delivery. So of the two of them, and I believe both of them started in college, of the two of them, I can see Dermody maybe getting a chance to start next season, whereas Silverstein, I think, is destined to be a loogie sort of role going forward.
All right. Well, I think nap time is over.
Yeah.
But it was great talking to you, Charlie, and good luck to the Vancouver Canadiens, and we look forward to your tweets of the game as it happens.
Yeah, well, I look forward to doing it. And, I mean, one thing I just want to quickly say is I think this is going to be the only chance the Seas get to see Mitch Ney and Matt Dean, so that's exciting as well, and I think they'll both slot right into the lineup, so something to look forward to.
So it's been confirmed that they've been called up?
Mitch Ney tweeted me back last night saying they were just about to board, and he said we. Uh-huh. So that's obviously him and Chase, and I can only assume with the team that, or sorry, the season that Matt Dean had, that he would have been on the flight, although that was not confirmed.
Well, that's fantastic to see. These guys really tore it up in the Appalachian League, or Appalachian League as they like to call it. If they are indeed with Vancouver as we speak, I think that could definitely add some extra base pop to that lineup.
Yeah, and I think it'll be a big help for LB, because I think one of the problems for him lately is just not seeing any pitches. with no, you know, sort of extra base threat behind them. Sorry, my daughter's not very happy right now.
Okay, well, we'll let you go take care of your daughter.
Perfect. And good talk to you. And, yeah, good luck to the Seas.
Okay, good luck. Finally, we're going to wrap up the season with Trey Wilson, the play-by-play radio voice for the Bluefield Blue Jays. Welcome back to the Blue Jays from Away podcast. I'm here with Trey Wilson, the play-by-play commentator for the Bluefield Blue Jays, who was Toronto's first playoff team who managed to get some playoff games this season. How are you doing today, Trey?
I'm doing well. It's a nice day here in Bluefield. Everybody's finally cleared out for the season, unfortunately, a little bit earlier than we had hoped. But it's nice to kind of move into the fall right now and feel things cool off, and it was nice to have such a good season this year in Bluefield. It'll be one that we all remember for a long time.
Well, it was a terrific season, but unfortunately the ending wasn't what I think anyone was really hoping for.
No, we certainly fell apart a little bit down the stretch, and I know a lot of people have said, man, you guys are getting crushed, and what is wrong with the team and all this. But really, if you look at those games over, you know, we ended up losing 9 out of the last 10 regular season games. But if you look at those games, there was a stretch of 3 out of 4 that were walk-offs. So many of them were one-run games, and a lot of them we led in those games. So it was just a matter of a few things late in games that got away from us after being so good out of the pen all year. A lot of our bullpen guys gave up runs late in the game, which really wasn't even a testament to them. There were a lot of errors behind them, especially with one of the holes that opened up on the infield once Thaiwell Lugo got called up to Vancouver. I think that was really a big focal point of the struggles down the stretch. But really, it was all over the place. The whole team kind of hit a wall right at the wrong time.
Well, not the entire team, because there was one or two guys in particular that really were powering through, and that was Matt Dean, who just went on a tear in August, didn't he?
Yeah. Matt was definitely a highlight point. And, you know, honestly, I have quietly made a stink to a few people about it just in some one-on-one conversation. But it's really frustrating to me that Matt Dean was not the Appalachian League Player of the Year. If you look at his numbers up next to Tyler Smith from Pulaski, the Mariners affiliate, who ended up winning it, Matt crushed Smith. I mean, in every category. The only category where Smith had him beat was in doubles, and he had one more double than Matt had. Matt beat him in batting average by 20 or 30 points. He had several more home runs, several more RBIs, more triples, and a better fielding percentage. That was another thing about Matt. Was in 2012, when Dean was with Bluefield at third, he really struggled defensively. He was kind of having a pretty, I mean, he was new in professional baseball, so you kind of expected it. But he moved over to first base this year. He really got it together nicely. He actually only had 2 errors on the whole season. He led the entire Appalachian League among qualifying players in fielding percentage for the season. So Matty had a huge turnaround. And then you look at his stretch that he went on, and I pulled up the numbers from where his lowest point with his batting average was, which was, hang on, let me double check and make sure I get it right. The season had kind of gotten going, on July 19th, Matty was hitting .238 on July 19th. He went over a stretch of the first 18 games in August, he hit .393 with 19 RBI. And if you look at the stretch from that August 19th to now, the end of the season, Matt hit in about a 6-week stretch, 40 games, he hit .395 and 129 at-bats, 51 for 129 with 17 extra base hits. He drove in 28 runs in those 40 games, had 5 home runs, 3 triples, 9 doubles. I mean, he just went on a tear from the plate over the last 6 weeks of the season. And that was something that I asked him about after the final game ended in the playoffs when Pulaski eliminated Bluefield. I didn't want to talk to him about it while he was on the streak. I didn't want to put anything in his head. He didn't even know what the numbers were. He just knew he was hitting better. And I said, Matty, what changed? And he kind of just laughed and said, You know, I have no idea. It's just one of those things where it clicked. And that's kind of what I really assumed. Something just clicked. There's no way to explain it. But the tear that Matt went on over the last 6 weeks of the season was quite reminiscent to Kevin Pillar 2 years ago. And I know that those are two entirely different players, entirely different stories, entirely different types of prospects. But if you looked at Pillar in 2011, about that same point in the year, midway through the season, he was struggling. He was hitting down in the 240s or 250, around 250, and he ended up going on a similar stretch over the final 6 weeks of the season, and he ended up hitting over 400 for the month of August to get his season batting average up to, I think it was 347 was where he finished in 2011, and he won the league's batting title that year by a tenth of a point. Dean had a little bit better edge this year in the batting title conversation over Jeff McNeil from the Kingsport Mets, who ended up finishing second, but it was a very similar type change at the plate. And I remember one of the people that Pillar talked to back in 2011 before he went on that stretch, and he talked about it a lot, was Steve Springer, who works with the Toronto Blue Jays at all the levels. He's a kind of a mental hitting coach. And Springer told him, take your numbers off the scoreboard. Ask them to take your stats off the scoreboard. And they asked him, and he did. And the scoreboard operator, or I guess the message center where it runs, that operator up in the press box left everybody's up except for Pillar's and took his off, and he just went on a tear. We now have a policy in place in Bluefield where we will not do that, because you go anywhere else, you go on the road, they're going to be there anyway. We don't think that that's necessarily the right way to do it, is to fully take it off of the scoreboard. So a few people asked this year, hearing about that story from Pillar a few years ago. But Dean, I think, did a good job of mentally blocking out anything that had to do with the numbers. He had no idea what his batting average was when the season ended. He had no clue. And I think that was probably a big thing for him, because he knew that he was hitting in the 220s and 230s at one point, but he had no idea where he finished. So I think that might have been a big thing for him, just being natural and comfortable at the plate and having a few things work in his favor.
Well, Dean is especially gratifying to see the turnaround on Matt Dean, particularly because he did have a fairly sluggish season last year with the Bluefield Blue Jays. And he's definitely a guy that hasn't escaped my radar. He was in that slump while I was in town, and I did see his swing at times got a little bit long, but he may have just been a little bit more diligent in making those adjustments, and finally they just click in and he goes on this tear. And he's definitely going to get my vote for the most improved player in the Blue Jays system year over year. I think that he's got that award, if there is such a thing, he's got that hands down.
And that's the thing with Matt that isn't necessarily any kind of a fluke. I mean, it's really a testament to how hard he works and how much of a competitor he is. And I know I sound like a coach right now with some coach speak things that they'll say about guys, but it's for several guys on this club this year, that was definitely the case. Matt does not want to be a guy that loses. He doesn't want to be some kind of bust either. You know, he really wants to improve, and he wants to become a better ball player, and that showed with he's the guy that likes to smile and laugh and have a good time, but when it comes time to get down to business, he takes things seriously, and he's really a grinder.
Well, that's great. And the other guy I was going to ask you about, and the rumors are swirling right now that both Matt Dean and Mitch Ney have been called up to Vancouver for their playoff push. I know that it's been sort of confirmed through Twitter that Ney for sure is going up there. Do you know anything about whether Matt Dean has been called up?
I just got confirmation to where we're allowed to make this public. It is going to be not Matt Dean. Matt Dean is not going up to Vancouver. It'll be Mitch is going, Chase DeYoung will be going, Brady Dragmire is going, and Jairo Labor. Those are the four guys from Bluefield that are going to be going up.
Okay, so I'll definitely let some people know, but Ney was definitely tweeting, and so was Chase DeYoung, and that has been confirmed, but we hadn't confirmed either Brady Dragmire or Jairo Labor. So that's good to know. They're going to get, hopefully, a little bit more action. I know Chase was probably a little disappointed they didn't get to Game 3 where he was supposed to pitch.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was talking to Chase on Sunday, the last day of the season, and he wanted to throw. I mean, he wants to throw, and he's excited to go up to Vancouver and throw. At this point in the year, especially with a lot of these young arms, they all feel like their arms are about to fall off. A lot of guys aren't stretched out a lot, really, but they're all such strong competitors. They want to get out there and definitely have a chance to make a run at a ring. Unfortunately, we fell short here in Bluefield, but certainly all the best wishes to Vancouver as they try to go for their third straight Northwest League title. We definitely want to see all the guys that we have had here in Bluefield succeed wherever they go, as is the case for the rest of the Blue Jays organization. We want to see them do well, but especially with the guys that have been here. And I think for our guys, I mean, they ended here in a disappointment, but for them to go up there and have a chance at a title run up in the Northwest League, I think that that'll be a good thing for them. And I think that a lot of the guys that were here are going to have an even, at the end of the season, we're here. Now, I'm not talking about guys like Tom Robson and Shane Dawson, who were gone earlier in the year, and Dawell Lugo even. But I know a lot of the guys that were here, most of these guys at this age haven't experienced a lot of losing. That's one of the things that I've noticed with the younger guys. These guys have won everything that they've ever done. I mean, that's a big thing about moving into pro ball, and where the landscape kind of evens out some, is experiencing losing for the first time. And I think that that's going to give a lot of these guys, the fact that they fell short in the Appalachian League, I mean, not to take away from how amazing of a run this season was. It was one of the best seasons that we've had in decades in Bluefield. But I know that coming short was definitely a disappointment for everybody, and that's not something that I'm not going to name anybody specifically, not going to name any certain specific guys, but you can see that it lit a fire with them. They want to win. These guys have never felt like that they have come short before. So just not all of them, but quite a few of them. So to see that fire relit in their eyes, I think that that'll be a big help moving forward into their baseball futures.
Well, let's talk about those playoff games. We had two playoff games. One was in Bluefield and one was in Pulaski. Why don't you tell our listeners about those two games?
You know, I still haven't exactly had enough time to settle in on those. It seems like just yesterday. It seems like an hour ago, if you're looking back, that we had a chance to make a run at this championship, and it was really, really a tough pill to swallow. But game one back at Bowen Field. I'll pull up the box score from it too, just to kind of aid my way through talking about it. It's that game never should have been the situation that it was in. That's the thing about this series, is honestly, in those two games against Pulaski, the Jays outplayed them. Bluefield outplayed them, and they beat them everywhere but on the scoreboard. And I guess kind of in their own heads. The game against Pulaski to start the playoffs, the Jays had the bases loaded in the bottom of the ninth with just one out. Nico Taylor came up. At the time, it was a 4-4 game. Just one out. Nico had just come off the bench, and you got to think he's going to come through on nothing against Nico. It's just, you know, he hit a ground ball to short. The shortstop, Tyler Smith for Pulaski, threw it home, and it cut down the base runner. I can't remember which base runner it was, but so that put it with the bases loaded and two outs, and Tim LaCastro grounded out to end the inning. And The pitcher that came in for Pulaski, I'm trying to remember his name off the top of the head. I'm pretty sure it was Rafael Pineda that came in. Well, he took over for Leoncio Munoz. That's who it was. Munoz came in. He walked the bases loaded, so we didn't even have any hits to get the bases loaded. And there was just that feeling of, all right, this is it. This is game one. I can't believe we're taking game one. They had Edwin Diaz, the pitcher of the year, on the mound, and Bluefield touched him up for four runs, three of them coming off of one big swing from Mitch Ney. I mean, a monster home run. And you've seen Bowen Field, and you've seen how deep it is out to the left center and right center field gaps, and you've seen how the ball doesn't really carry out there. Well, this ball was just launched over that big hit it here sign, the gas station sign.
Right.
It was a monster shot. It might have been a little bit to the left of it. He got a good piece of it. And you go into the bottom of the ninth inning, or you're in the bottom of the ninth inning with the bases loaded, one out, thinking there's no way that we don't score a run here. And then it doesn't come to be. Some great defense by Pulaski all game, not to take away from them. And then we went into the top of the 10th inning, and it all just kind of fell apart. Phil Kish got knocked around a little bit, which is not something that you've really been able to say about Kish all year long. He's pitched very well going back to the GCL and in the Appalachian League. And even in the time that I saw him pitching in college with Southeastern, I called some games that he had down there. He never gave up any runs, even if he came out for a second inning. Well, he came out and he gave up five runs, and that's not necessarily all of them were his fault. A little bit of defensive lapses behind him, but it doesn't matter. That one was behind us. Dennis Holmberg got tossed in that game, which is not something that ever happens. It happened twice this year, and both times I have to 100% side with Dennis on him. The first game, he was arguing an overturned call that never should have been overturned. Once the call's made, it's got to stick, and he ended up getting thrown out of that game. Not a big deal. Walks off the field. All right, there you go. First time being thrown out since he came to Bluefield. This game, he was having a conversation with the umpire after Derek Loveless legged out a triple. And everybody in the ballpark, including all the Pulaski people that were there, from the team side standpoint, their media guy, their radio guy, and even some of their players after the game talking about it, Loveless was in. He was almost standing back up by the time the tag got applied. But he got called out, and that ended a big rally on an inning. And the next batter came up, and nobody on, and grounded out. And Dennis, walking back, had a couple more words with the umpire and just saying, you know, basically, probably, I don't know exactly what he said, but I know Dennis, and he wouldn't go out of his way to say anything out of line, but he said something to the umpire walking in the dugout. He got thrown. There may not have been some items thrown out of the dugout. I know a lot of people have mentioned that because it's made its way around social media, and even some of the larger national media outlets have asked for some video of that, which we do not have, so please don't ask. But that there were a couple of calls in that ball game, and I don't like it to ever pin anything on an umpire. But going against both teams, there were some calls that really changed the entire complexion of that game. And it's a shame that that's what it came down to for game one. But game two was not the story. I mean, it was a well officiated game. We just really shot ourselves in the foot. Came out and made a bunch of errors. A bunch of young guys made a bunch of errors and allowed a few runs to score. I think the final box score is only going to show for that game us having three errors, but we had more than three. There were some that they gave their teams hits on that were, it was kind of 50-50 in between calls. But Eddie Campbell came out for the Mariners, former Virginia Tech Hokies pitcher, left-hander with good stuff, and he really did a good job keeping us off the board for the most part outside of one kind of rough inning. And Alberto Tirado had a very good outing as well. That was a good pitcher's duel for a little while through the first couple of innings, and some runs, some unearned runs came across the board, and then it was just an explosion of runs in the fourth inning, and then the pitchers came back in and shut everything down for the rest of the game, and we just couldn't overcome the deficit that got put up there with a bunch of unearned runs. Tirado gave up 5 runs in that game, to put that fourth inning into perspective. Tirado gave up 5 runs, and just one of them were earned. There were a handful of errors, and I don't remember exactly where they all were. I remember who made them, but I don't want to call anybody out because it doesn't matter. The season's over now, and that's what this league is for growth, and we're not going to hold anything above the heads of any of these young ball players.
So we'll just say that while the team had a chance to win, they just couldn't put it away and take either of the two games.
That's just how it played out. If it's a best of five series, maybe it goes differently. If a couple of things go, if a couple of balls bounce a different way, it's a whole different series. That's just the way it goes sometimes. It's part of what makes baseball great. And just unfortunately this time, for about a 2-week stretch, we came on the wrong side of that.
Well, and sometimes if you believe in them, sometimes the baseball gods just don't smile on one team. And it looks like that was kind of the case.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the road trip to end the season was absolutely brutal. We went down to Greenville, one of the longest trips that we have in this league in Tennessee, the Astros affiliate. And, the first night there, we have the game in hand and end up making an error that allows the tying run to come in. And then they end up walking off on us in the bottom of the 10th. And then, the second night there, I might have these flipped, but one of the nights there, we're in the bottom of the ninth or the tenth. I think this one was the bottom of the ninth in game two. And we have first and third with one out. And Greenville has a batter at the plate that his name escapes me right now. It's been a week ago. Seems like a month and a half ago, kind of in that respect. But the guy had already grounded into 2-4-6-3 double plays in this game. And I'm thinking in my head, all right, here comes number three. Let's send this one to extra innings. He hits a ground ball to the second baseman, and I think it was Maldonado, and at the time he flips it up to Barreto, and Barreto throws it over Matt Dean's head and into the dugout, and the game-winning run scores. They walked off on us in that game. And then the third game of that series, another error helped across the go-ahead run for a 2-1 lead for the Astros in the bottom of the eighth inning, and then they came in and shut it down in the ninth. And then Kingsport walked off on in the 10th inning of the first game of that series, that three-game set. And then the next two nights, Kingsport just really had their way. Our guys were pretty depleted, and you could tell that maybe we were saving a couple of arms for the playoffs, and playoff spot was already clinched, and it just those two games I don't really consider to be indicative of how we were necessarily playing at the time. And then we moved into those playoff games, which we've already talked about.
Right. Well, it was otherwise a very good season for the Bluefield Blue Jays. A lot of talent on that team. A lot of guys that I think are going to be moving up and probably moving up significantly, getting out of short season ball, I think, next year. Is there anybody who really stood out for you that you think, you know, this kid is going to really make it? I know it's so difficult at this level, and particularly because the players are so young and because they're such works in progress, but is there anyone that really stood out and you made you say, you know what, this guy's got it together, he is going to really be something?
Well, definitely Matt Dean. I mean, he's got so many tools, and he showed some versatility this year, bouncing back and forth between playing third and first. He's a solid defensive infielder, and you've seen his swing. I mean, if anybody hasn't seen his swing, I urge you to go find wherever he's playing next year and watch him play. And the same thing goes for Mitch Ney. That's a swing that you want to see in person because it's there. But Mitch Ney and Matt Dean, as far as infielders go, very solid, very high-ceiling guys. And Matt, you started to see kind of mold into that this year. Mitch, we've all seen the power, and we know that the power's there. But to watch, I mean, Mitch's mental, his mental capacity for baseball and situational hitting is something that maybe he hadn't gotten a lot of credit for. I know that everybody wanted to see him hit more home runs this year than he did. He hit 6 plus 1 in the playoffs, 7, and one of those was an inside the Parker on one of the weirdest plays that I've seen. But his situation, looking at some of the different situations, with the bases empty, Mitch hit 237. I mean, he wasn't necessarily great at starting rallies. If the guys went down 1-2-3 in the top of the first, or in the first inning, then he comes up to start the second, I think in that four spot. But with runners on, that jumped all the way up to 366. And with runners in scoring position for the season, he hit 400. And honestly, for a big chunk of the year, until the very last couple of weeks of the year, it was higher than that. And he ended up leading the league with 42 RBIs. And just to watch his approach at the plate change when there were runners on or when there were runners in scoring position, he wasn't trying to hit home runs. I mean, if you got a pitch that was just left out on a platter for him, he would demolish it. And that baseball would really regret ever being thrown by that pitcher because I don't know if a lot of them would ever come down. But when he would come up with, you know, like runners on second and third, one out, you know, he'd look to hit the ball the other way. He'd hit some tweeners, some ground balls to the right side between the first baseman and the second baseman that would find their way on the right field and bring across a couple of runs. And I think that shows, even at his age, his first professional season, just to think that, God, this kid's in his first professional season. He was playing high school ball 15 months ago. He's definitely going to be a guy to watch out for so many reasons other than what people have told you to look for.
Right, and actually one of the things that I really noticed, and yes, I did see Mitch Ney hit a towering home run while I was there, in addition to demolishing the ball in batting practice, but one of the things that I think really speaks to his maturity as a hitter is it looks like he led the team in at-bats, and he was only sixth in strikeouts, with only 35 strikeouts and 25 walks, which is very impressive for a power hitter who's only 19 years old.
That's the thing. Again, that has to do with his approach at the plate, and I hadn't noticed that number. I know he was striking out quite a bit at the beginning of the season, but I noticed that he had certainly cut down the strikeouts later in the year, but that's another sign of him and his approach to the plate, which you got to give credit to all the guys that come down from Toronto and work with these guys and the roving hitting instructors, and a lot of credit, I'm sure, to Ken Huckabee, who was the hitting coach this year in Bluefield. That's something that you saw with a lot of guys this year on this team, and it starts as a top-down message in the organization, you know, the different things that they want to work in with these batters, with these hitters. And some guys, I guess, just grab it by the horns and take off with a little bit better. And that part you can certainly give credit to Mitch for.
Well, that's fantastic. And how about one pitcher, especially somebody who finished the season with the team? We know we've talked to Charlie Caskey, who covers the Vancouver Canadiens already, and he was definitely very high on Tom Robson and Shane Dawson, having seen them up there. But how about a pitcher who's finished the season in Bluefield this season? Who's one that you really think stood out from the rest of them?
Well, there were certainly a few guys that I wanted to get a mentioning of, and obviously everybody is locked in on guys like Alberto Chirado. He kind of came into this year with some eyeballs looking at him. Everybody knew that he was going to have good stuff, and he's a guy that is an absolute competitor when he's out there on the mound. If he's got some maturing, and I think if you talk to Antonio Caceres right now, I don't want to put any words in his mouth, but he would probably say about the same thing. He and Jairo Labor both are guys that are will get inside their own head a little bit, especially early in the game. Chirado would walk the bases loaded and start some games. Not that extreme, but then he'd ramp the fastball up to 97 miles an hour and work his way out of jams. He's very feisty. He's very twitchy, and he wants to win. You see a lot of guys that don't necessarily give a lot of effort toward the wins and losses at this level. That's not the case for Alberto Chirado. He wants his team to win. He does not want a single run to come up on the board, whether it's an earned run. And he does a good job. He just has a few mechanical things and mental things that he still needs to work on. Labor has very good stuff. I think he started to kind of hit a wall toward the end of the year, but he's a lefty that'll run it up there into the low mid 90s, and I'm anxious to see where he is a year from now. I'd like to come back and look at Labor again in 12 months and see what a year in another level does for him. Chase DeYoung, unfortunately for him, he had a 2-3 record on the year, but he didn't pitch that poorly. He kept his ERA right down at 3 and brought it down, because really he got knocked around a little bit at the beginning of the year. But that curveball is, I would never want to see that at the plate. It's it goes pretty much right from 12 to 6 on the clock, and it's certainly effective. Chase has got a very good future that's going to start with that curveball, and he's got good other pitches as well as fastball, and his other secondary pitches to go along with the curveball are very good. And Brady Dragmire is a guy that didn't really know what to expect out of this year, but he came through in some big games, working in the rotation, working out of the bullpen, whatever they asked him to do. He ended up, his ERA got a little inflated at the end of the year, up to 216. He ended up with a 3-2 record, but he would go out there. He doesn't have overpowering stuff. He's got this fastball run up about 88 miles an hour, and he's right-handed. That's not anything that's going to necessarily draw some eyeballs just when you're looking at those two factors. But he has so much sink on the fastball, and it's a heavy two-seamer. I mean, guys can't get good contact on it most of the time. He's going to be a guy that gets a lot of ground balls, and when he needs to, he uses those secondary pitches to get some swings and misses, and works the strikeouts. There was a game where he had 6 strikeouts over, I think, the first 6, 7, 8 batters that he faced. I think it was the first 8 batters that he faced in a game against the Princeton Rays at home. The Princeton was miserable offensively, but that shouldn't take away from the fact that these are still professional ball players. And Brady had a lot of good stuff this year. I think that he was kind of my under-the-radar guy that really, by the end of the year, when I looked at his numbers, I said, really? You know, I knew he did really well, but he did really better than I might have thought. And he did it as a starter, and he started out the year as a guy in the back of the bullpen. He picked up 2 saves in his first 3 outings. So that's definitely another guy that I would be anxious to see what he does at another level.
Well, that's great, and hopefully he'll get a chance to pitch for the Canadiens in their playoff hopes. And thanks again for joining us. We're going to let you go. We know you've got a busy time. And once again, thanks for joining us and the Blue Jays From Away podcast. And we hope you have a great fall and a great winter.
Thanks, you too, and really looking forward to next season. I hope if I'm not in Bluefield, somewhere within the Blue Jays organization. The plan right now is to be with Bluefield, but I'm looking forward to seeing some of the guys that we will have coming next year, especially what I got to see out of Riley Tellez a little bit in a little bit of time that he got to spend with us. So it's going to be fun. Have a good offseason.
That wraps it up for episode number 17 of the Blue Jays From Away podcast, our special playoff edition. I'd like to thank Tyler Murray, Charlie Caskey, and Trey Wilson for joining me. I'd also like to thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Jays From Away. Come on back next week and go Jays go. No, no, no.